The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Kids physically now are having problems. Mentally, they're having problems. Emotionally, academically, relationally, just their ability to communicate. Everything is being torn apart by these apps because their brain is wired for novelty. Their brain is wired to seek out anything new and exciting and then to mimic it. So the reason why there's so many problems with the identity issue that we have in our culture is because kids are so confused.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, we got an important issue to talk about. Thanks for being here with me today. If you have a loved one who is suffering from anxiety or depression, you're going to want to listen to some of this conversation and a new study that has come out. I've always believed, and I was very perplexed at the rise of anxiety amongst this younger generation. And I said, there's got to be something driving it. I don't remember it. Is it more diagnosed today than it has ever been? Did you know, when I was growing up, did kids have it and we just didn't know? Did parents not know? They just thought these kids were hyper. As they say, the kid's hyper is whatever, overactive. No, I don't think so. You know, I think it's something totally different. I shared with you just a few moments ago about the crippling anxiety of one individual who, just has limited his ability to work and to get out and to fulfill the mission I think that God has in store for that particular individual. Kids are exposed today to screens at such a young age, such an unbelievable age. And I think it's having a profound impact on everything from anxiety to depression. There was a recent study that was done. Before I tell the study, did you hear about the lawsuit? There's a lawsuit out right now. And this shocked me. This came out of Seattle, right? The city of Seattle, of all places. They're doing something which I think is kind of conservative, right? The public school system there recently filed a lawsuit. It could make a huge difference in the lives of a lot of people. The suit is against Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and TikTok, and Snapchat, right? And so, well, what's the lawsuit about? This is what they're saying. They said, you know, that they have successfully exploited the vulnerable brains of our youth. They've hooked tens of millions of students across the country onto positive feedback loops of excessive use and abuse of defendants' social media platforms. That's what they are alleging. That's what the suit is charging. Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat. I hope they're successful. I really do. According to a recent study, and they have that exactly right, researchers at the University of North Carolina studied an ethnically diverse group of about 170 students in 6th and 7th grade from middle school in rural Carolina, and they split them into groups according to how they reported checking social media feeds. Habitual users reported checking their feeds 15 times a day. Moderate users checked between 1 and 14. Non-habitual, you know, they check less than once a day. The kids received these brain scans. They got full brain scans at approximately one-year intervals. They played a computerized game that delivered rewards and punishments in the form of, you know, smiling or scowling peers. So while they did the game, the kids that checked their feeds frequently, guess what they found out? They showed increased activation in three areas of the brain: the reward processing circuits, the regions that help you see what stands out in the environment, and the area that helps you regulate and control. And one of the researchers said the results showed teens who grow up checking their social media or in front of this stuff all the time, they become more hypersensitive to feedback from their peers. Whether or not that's necessarily a bad thing is another question, but the findings didn't show necessarily how much the brain changes, but it is showing other things. And here today to give us some insight into that is Dr. Leonard Sachs. And he's a psychologist, he's a physician in Exton, Pennsylvania, and he has talked with us about this in the past. He's written some books, The Collapse of Parenting, Why Gender Matters, Boys Adrift, Girls on the Edge. You can check him out at leonardsachs.com. Those books are all must-read for any parent. Doctor, it's good to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Thanks for inviting me.
This Well, let's start with the lawsuit before we talk about the science. That lawsuit, the Seattle School District against Big Tech, to me, that seems like a major deal. What are they seeing in their students that thought they should file a lawsuit, and what do you make of it? How successful do you think they might be?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not the right person to ask about the odds of success. But it is remarkable that, as you said, Seattle, of all places, would file this suit, that their legal counsel clearly thinks that this is has a chance of winning, that they assert that the social media are a public nuisance. I think it'd be... great. And I think it also is a reminder to parents that this stuff is really harmful. And we as parents need to be aware of this. We need to limit how much our kids are doing on this. I did want to add a comment to your summary of the really important article published last week on the brain study. The key thing to understand in brain development is that maturation is a process of gaining control and inhibiting activity in some of these brain areas, like the amygdala. Amygdala is clearly related to aggressive feeling and aggressive action. And as you get older, you're supposed to be able to tone that down. And it is a characteristic of brain development in humans that as you get older, you reduce. Right. Amygdala activity. What's really striking about this paper, when you pull up the actual images of the brain development, is that they're seeing that kids who are using social media a lot are showing the opposite pattern. Instead of becoming more mature over time, they're becoming less mature over time. The brains of kids using social media a lot are developing differently than the brains of kids who do not use social media a lot. This is big news because this is the first such study to demonstrate with a longitudinal cohort study, meaning they followed these kids over 3 years, not just a single snapshot, but over 3 years, they find that the kids using social media are becoming less mature over time. And that's a really striking finding and unexpected.
I was struck by that, too. In some of the research I did, I found that they are arguing that excessive screen use is linked to what they call a decline in, quote, crystallized intelligence and fluid intelligence. What's that mean? A decline of basically your executive function. So what's executive function? Brain activities that are crucial to adulthood, and to your point,
self-control.
They say for to remember instructions, the ability to plan, to multitask between tasks, to complete these tasks, and the other thing was control impulses and process sensory input and regulate social behavior and even have self-awareness. So that's a mess. You have no impulse control and you have no self-awareness. That's a formula for a lot of problems.
Yeah, and this is such a striking study because, you know, previously I and many others have argued that social media are harmful and increase the risk of anxiety and depression, and we did have evidence for that, but we didn't have evidence that it was actually changing the brain, and that's what makes this study different, is that it's actually showing that the brain is developing differently among kids who are using social media a lot, and that difference is not a good difference. It's that the brain is becoming less mature, that areas of the brain involving self-control and self-regulation are not maturing as they should.
It's actually quite frightening, and that brings us to this lawsuit. I mean, I'm glad somebody is... The social media platforms do this deliberately. They create this stuff so it is... It's addictive. And I'm concerned not just about, I think it was Congressman Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin who called it digital fentanyl is what he called this stuff. And it's true. But I see parents today, doctor, and I can understand teenagers wanting this. They got cell phones, they got tablets, they got their different devices that they use. But parents today with their toddlers, there was a study in the Journal of Pediatrics found that just 1 hour of screen time a day was linked to diminished executive functions in children as young as 2 years old. Parents are giving I guess, tablets to kids that are 2 years old. How dangerous is that for that developing brain?
Well, we now have a good study on that as well, where they actually looked at kids 3, 4, and 5 years of age who were given phones to calm them down. Parents, and I see this in the office every day.
Wow.
Mom brings her 3-year-old to be seen, and mom is pushing the phone on the kid to look at SpongeBob SquarePants so the kid won't make a fuss while we're talking, which I don't mind a kid making a fuss, but mom's got him looking at SpongeBob SquarePants. And we now have very good evidence that down the road has just the opposite effect. Kids are less able to calm themselves, more irritable. And again, this is what's new. It's not just a guess anymore. You follow these kids over time. You follow that the kids who are 3, 4, 5 years of age are using the phone or are being given a phone to calm themselves down will be less able to calm themselves down. So it's a really bad idea.
Yeah, to me, it's absolutely striking. If you want to join us, too, I have Dr. Sachs with me only for about 15 minutes today. I know a lot of parents are probably concerned about their young kids who are playing on the iPad to keep them busy, as you point out, or whether or not it's that teenager that really is struggling with anxiety and has very low self-esteem. A lot of this is, of course, all intertwined. You can join us here, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I think few parents, doctors, are going to be surprised that excessive screen use is associated with emotional problems like depression and anxiety, but maybe not. You know, a lot of people think, well, what about moderate use of screens? From what I understand, even moderate use, it was linked to lower psychological well-being. Higher screen use doubled the likelihood of the depression of depression or anxiety. I mean, this is a real problem. I've always really believed there was some connection to these devices. There seems like in recent days it's been there's been an increase in this type of anxiety and depression amongst people. I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me for prayer for this. So break it down for me. How does it work? You know, is there a tipping point for when this really becomes dangerous?
I think Jonathan Haidt put it very well. He's a researcher at New York University, and he's been studying this very closely with his colleagues. He said, imagine if we shot kids into outer space and had them live in a zero-gravity space station as they're growing. But they don't have any gravity. How would that affect their bone development? How would it affect their muscle development? What would be a catastrophe? Because we are hardwired to live on planet Earth and have gravity. And that's how you develop strong bones and strong muscles. If you're in outer space with no gravity, your bones are going to be weak and your muscles are going to be weak. He says social media is the same problem. We let kids go into their bedrooms and look at screens and interact via screens. It's not what we are meant to do. We are meant for face-to-face encounters with other living human beings. That's how kids have always lived. And now we let them shut themselves up in a bedroom with a screen. It's like shooting into outer space with no gravity. And we expect them to turn out normal. Well, big surprise, they don't. Kids need face-to-face encounters to develop normal social understanding of other humans. You don't get that from a screen. You don't get that from Instagram or TikTok. And so this catastrophe that we're seeing emerging right now, this ongoing catastrophe of anxiety and depression that's getting worse year by year, is not surprising. Kids don't flourish with screens. They need human encounters. So parents, you've got to turn off the screens, limit what your kids are doing online, and encourage them to interact with other kids in the real world.
I don't know how we deal with this, though, Doc, to be honest with you, because schools, they use tablets, they use computers now. Constantly, screens are always in front of kids. There was one estimate that said 97% of kids go online every day. 97, it's almost every kid, right? And 46% say they're online almost constantly. So it's a companion. Mm-hmm. I think these things are also addictive. You know, when you're not on it, they feel that withdrawal, like they want to be on it. I wonder what that portends for the future, because we're at a very different time today. Societally, we've never had this before. And I think other countries like China, when it came to TikTok and devices like that, they didn't let their adolescents have exposure to some of the stuff that American adolescents have. I mean, if they did a search, it would be on how to do better in math or to do a science experiment. Here, you're seeing everything from cat videos on to how to put your makeup on. I mean, whatever's on TikTok, you know what I mean? So what does it portend for the future in your opinion?
Well, you mentioned China, and I think it's sobering that China has put in place very serious limits on the time that kids can spend online. And they enforce that in a way that you cannot do in a free society. Everyone's got ID, and if you try and log in as someone else, your parents can get in big trouble. So they really are enforcing this, that kids cannot spend a lot of time. Children, teenagers in China cannot spend a lot of time looking at screens, playing video games. Now, I do not regard China as a role model for the United States. But if you pose the question, okay, 20, 30 years down the road, we've got one culture where kids have no limits and are spending all their free time looking at screens. And we've got another culture where kids are limited by law and are encouraged to study instead of looking at screens. Which of those cultures is going to prevail? It's a sobering question.
I agree. Totally agree. My guest, Dr. Leonard Sachs. We'll go to the phones in just a second at 888-914-9149. If you want to join us, you can certainly do that as we're taking a look at the impact that screen time is now having, social media is having, on everything from two-year-olds to adults. And I bet you've got a child or a niece or a nephew or a grandchild that is either suffering from OCD or from depression or from anxiety. And I want to talk about OCD, too. That was something that struck me in this report. But before we do that, let's go to the phones. We'll grab a call or two. I only have about 10 minutes left of my next guest. Daniel's listening in Los Angeles, California. Daniel, you're on the air with Dr. Sachs. Good afternoon.
Hi. Good afternoon, Doctor. Good afternoon, Drew.
Hey.
Yeah, I just had a comment just listening to what you guys are talking about. My wife and I have tried to not give a tablet or phone to our kids, especially when we're out. They'll throw, they'll scream. And, sometimes we kind of get the look from other people at restaurants, but we try to just keep them engaged, talk to them a lot. And what I've noticed if we go to other parties or anywhere with other couples, we see, parents kind of handing tablets or phones. But I've noticed just developmentally, our kids talk a lot compared to tablet kids, in other words. And my son has a tendency to just grasp on small little things of our conversation then repeat it later on that day or the following day.
Yeah.
That's just a couple of things that I've noticed just in being out, and whereas anyone with a tablet, typically their development is a little slower. My kid's only two, but he'll sometimes repeat things from the day before that he heard from his uncle. We went to In-N-Out and he was literally saying oh, Uncle David, because my brother was talking about it the other day.
Hey, David. Daniel, thank you. I'm going to let Dr. Sachs comment. Go right ahead, Doctor.
Yeah, Daniel mentioned restaurants, and we go out to a restaurant, and the family at the next table—mother, father, son, and daughter—they're all looking at a screen. They're all looking at their own screen, and they're not talking to each other. And you want to just shake them and say, "What are you doing? What are you thinking? What's the point of going to a restaurant if you're just going to look at your screens?" It's amazing that we have so quickly forgotten what it means to be human. It means interacting with the person sitting next to you and not looking at a device. And how are kids supposed to learn this if their parents don't know? In order to be a better parent, you've got to be a better person. You've got to put the screen down and engage your child. And the kid has a fever and a sore throat. I get that.
Yeah.
But don't hand them a screen and tell them to look at SpongeBob SquarePants. You're the parent. You want to engage them. You want to say to them, hey, come on, we can get through this together. I can comfort you better than a screen. It's troubling that so many parents think that the screen can do a better job than they can at comforting and relaxing their kid.
That's so true. I was reading about this this OCD too, which, you know, I understood anxiety, understood depression. I don't know whether there's a rise in OCD or not. That, you know, this is not my area of expertise. But part of this one study that was done, the Journal of Sociology and Family 21, it said that excessive screen time is linked to the atrophy in the frontal, the striatal, and insular cortex regions of the brain, and specifically reduction in the thickness of the orbitofrontal cortex. And the thinning of the orbitofrontal cortex has been shown, it says, to significantly impact memory and can increase the incidence of obsessive compulsive disorder. I know academics are affected by this. They're seeing grade point averages drop. But OCD, are we really seeing a physiological change in the brain as a result of this now too? I mean, that's stunning study to me, stunning finding.
Well, it's again striking that the study that you and I are talking about published 1 week ago, showing how kids who frequently look at social media have changes in exactly those areas of the brain you just mentioned, ventral striatum, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. We're now starting to be able to connect the dots and see at a fundamental neurological way how all this time that these 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 15-year-olds are spending on social media, it's changing the brain. It's setting them up for OCD, anxiety, and depression.
What about anger? I was reading somewhere, I don't know where it was, but there may also be a link to anger issues in a lot of kids. Is that the case? Does this affect them emotionally?
Well, yeah,
that way?
And again, this new study, looking at the amygdala, I mean, the amygdala is kind of the anger center of the brain. And again, as I mentioned earlier, a feature of human brain development is that as you mature, as you move through adolescence, you are able to tamp down that activity in the amygdala. And this study showed very strikingly that kids who are not habitually checking their social media, they are able to gain control over their amygdala. As they get older, amygdala activity decreases. But the kids who are constantly checking their social media, they saw the opposite pattern. Instead of less activity in the amygdala, the anger center, you see more activity in the 15-year-old than you do in the 12-year-old. Wow. So it's really troubling.
Yeah, there's more research from the preventative medicine that found that moderate use of screen time was linked to lower psychological well-being, high screen time, more than double the likelihood of depression and anxiety, as we talked about. But then I looked, I said, well, what's the average time? I mean, how much time is too much time? How much time is okay? The data I found said that teens are now averaging 9 hours a day of screen time. Those who are 8 to 12 years of age, about 8 hours. That's crazy. I mean, that's a lot of screen time, doctor. Is there a certain amount of, time that is safe? And how much time is too much time?
We have good research addressing just that question. So Gene Twenge, certainly our nation's leading researcher on this topic, did a big study published 2019. Over 200,000 adolescents. On the x-axis, you have time spent on social media. On the y-axis, you have the risk of becoming anxious or depressed. There's no increase in that curve until you reach 30 minutes. 30 minutes a day. Beyond 30 minutes, you have a pretty linear upward curve. So from 2019 until very recently, I would say less than 30 minutes a day on social media is okay for teenagers. However, more recent research is coming up with different answers. And I corresponded with Professor Twenge. I said, Professor Twenge, your latest work suggests that 30 minutes a day is not okay, that any time on social media is a problem. And you and I both know why that is. It's because of TikTok. Yeah. TikTok is a game changer. TikTok is much more toxic for children and teenagers than Instagram or other social media ever was. And I said, has this changed your recommendation? And on October 3rd, she sent me an email back saying, yes, she now says the data supports a total ban on social media for kids under 18. There is no safe amount of time for a child or teenager to be on social media.
I want to sneak a call or two in, but before I do, before I go to Rosie and everyone else that's here, is there a way to heal? For example, I know the brain's an amazing organ, you know. Can fasting change things? Is separation, you know, once you withdraw from this, I know studies have been done with porn, as men stay away from it, they seem to be able to stay away from it more.
Got to go cold turkey. I've counseled many families on this. You've got to go cold turkey. And yes, you can heal as long as we're still talking about a child or teenager.
Wow.
The most discouraging email I get, and I get them regularly, mm-hmm. is the parent who says, my son is withdrawn and depressed, has no motivation. Right. He's 29 years old. Right. He's not working and he's not looking for work.
Yep.
What can you offer me? And my answer, which I tried to sugarcoat as much as possible, is I have nothing. I have nothing to offer you. Once that brain is fully developed, you cannot easily make a change. But the good news is, if you're talking about a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old, you still have time. Go cold turkey. Girls do not reach maturity in brain development until 22 years of age. Boys, not until 29 or 30 years of age. So you've still got time for the brain to recover and to become a human brain again, instead of a video game accessory or a computer accessory. So parents have to have the courage to turn off the device, to limit and govern what kids are doing with their devices. And the sooner you do it, the better off your kid will be.
Well, Doctor, I am very grateful for your time. If you're on hold, our conversation is going to continue. I'm going to change gears a little bit, but I'll have to have you back to explore this in even greater detail. I know you've written several books. Is there a resource or a book or something you think parents should read that may help them through these troubled waters?
You know, I'm a big fan of Gene Twenge's most recent book, Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E, and the book is iGen. I-G-E-N, her name for the current generation of young people. The first chapter I would skip. It's mostly introductory, but you get beyond that, and it's a deep dive into how toxic social media is, how toxic screens are, how kids are spending less time with other kids today, more time alone. The rate of violent crime among teenagers in the United States has dropped. The rate of suicide has skyrocketed. As Gene Twenge says, kids are no longer killing each other. They're killing themselves.
She's been a friend of the show. We've had her on many, many times. And I'm grateful you guys are both friends now that you're communicating.
Yes.
Doctor, I got to leave it right there. I hear my bumper running. I'm up against the clock. Thank you being here with us. Again, people can check you out, right? It's LeonardSax.com. Best way to connect?
Yes, sir. S-A-X.
We'll catch up again. Appreciate your time. Very valuable.
Thank you.
Say a prayer for Dr. Leonard Sax. Check out his books. They're must-reads. They belong in your spiritual library, also in your parental library. Also, check out his website. When we come back, we'll talk more about this, the inevitable death of social media. Somebody's making a case for that and the rise of AI.
We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/Forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Your Life Connected, The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for being here with me today. If you missed any of the conversation today, and we had some great ones, check out our podcast. Maggie will have that up on Spotify and Apple and here at relevantradio.com and wherever you get your podcast. Well worth re-listening and well worth sharing with others. I want to take this in a step further. You know, as we're taking a look at social media, it's almost getting to the point where people are defining themselves by it, right? It's an intricate part of their life. There was a Pew Research poll that was done in 2021. It found that 81% of American adults use YouTube, 69% use Facebook. I thought Facebook would have been higher, but 81% adults, you know, use YouTube, 69% Facebook. That's the study I saw. Others, of course, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, Snapchat, Twitter, so on, whatever one you use, all scored 40% and below, right? All those other ones, 40% below. So those are the two big ones, YouTube and Facebook. Of course, a lot of people have individual accounts on each of those platforms. You might, right? Maybe you had a Twitter account, a Facebook account. I don't know. Just the sheer numbers that just indicate how much time we're looking at those screens. So I read a piece and I reached out to TJ Burdick. He's the man who wrote the piece. He wrote a piece about the death of social media. And I thought this is well worth talking about. We're going to be joined in just a moment by my next guest. I'm grateful for his patience. He wrote a book called Unintended Dystopia, which another guest just recently plugged. Russ White will be stopping by here. But let me tell you about the case he made, because I do find it's interesting. He says, you know, there are celebrities who use all these social media platforms, right? A lot of them are leaving. They're leaving the platforms. They say it doesn't work. Some of the names you might know, like Kate Blanchett, Chris Pine, the Cloonies, Julia Roberts, Kate Winslet, Daniel Radcliffe. Burdick believes social media, this is his case, this is what he's arguing, that social media's demise is inevitable because there's a tug on our heart every time we use it. Now, I don't know whether you feel this way or not. Maggie, maybe you do. You know in your conscience that maybe there's a better way of spending your time. Maybe dealing with real life, you feel, gosh, I'm wasting time, or what I'm seeing here is not edifying, or what I'm seeing here is leading me into some sort of sinful behavior. Or, I mean, there's a lot of darkness. I tend to think it's inherently neutral. If it's used for good, goods are multiplied. If it's used for evil, evils are multiplied. But Burdick makes a case that, you know, it's a time suck, and eventually, you know, it's going to end. I do think it's created to keep us in a loop, and this feedback loop is addictive, and I think we need to somehow break the addiction. We'll see what happens. Unfortunately, even if it dies, there's another problem. I saw a story. I was telling Maggie about this just before the show, and she told me something I didn't hear about. There's a new, and you might have seen these news reports. There's something new called ChatGPT, okay? It's artificial intelligence that people can use for writing. They can use it for writing code. They can use it for all sorts of things, creating all sorts of problem solving, research, right? Colleges now have to be on the lookout for it because kids could tell their computer, hey, computer, you know, write me a paper on the decline of Napoleon Bonaparte, or write me a haiku, or write me this poem, or whatever. And it will spit out a paper in the middle, just a matter of seconds, right? I actually checked it out the other day. I thought, man, this might be a great research tool for me. So I went online. It's in the beta version right now. And I said, give me stories of individuals who had conversions as a result of the Eucharist. And it said, Thomas Aquinas said that the Eucharist is blah, blah, blah. St. Teresa of Avila would spend hours. And they went through, didn't really give me the stories I wanted, so I reissued it. It gave me a choice to give a second round of searches. This time it gave me a result. And it said, Tom went into the church, and as he was sitting there contemplating the Eucharist, had a profound impact on him and decided to enter more deeply into the faith. He became a deacon in church. And I said, well, who's this guy Tom? I asked the AI. The AI wrote back to me and said, Tom is a fictional character I created in order to illustrate an example to you based on your query, right? And I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. You got to be careful because not all the information is accurate, right? It is not, and they even say that when you go on there. Maggie was sharing with me. She says there's artwork that could be created that's out there. She says, just imagine you want something painted in the Renaissance style, right? And say you want Darth Vader landing in the cornfields of Kansas, right? You know, and you want it done in the Renaissance style, it'll create that art for you. In fact, I was looking at a friend of mine who does television production, and he had this beautiful image of something he used in a piece he did, and it looked like heaven. And I said, how did you find that piece? He said, oh, I created that. Well, actually, this piece of software, it's AI generated. I'm like, are you kidding me? So art, all these things can be generated. There was an Orthodox priest who wanted ideas for a sermon this past Sunday. And he asked the AI, the artificial intelligence, to give him three possible sermons based on the opening prayer, the epistle and the gospel. And he says what came back were all great ideas. So I have a friend who was really upset by this. He's a writer. He's a researcher. And he hated the idea. He goes, what happens to human creativity, right? Is this good? Does it serve us? Is there a danger one day we may be serving it? Well, Russ White joins me today. We'll explore this. He's a well-known voice of computer networking. He's co-host of The Hedge and the History of Networking podcasts and serves on the Internet Architectural Board and is in a leadership role at the FR of Routing, opensource.com. Good to have him here with us today. Thank you for your time, Russ. Good to have you back once again. Good afternoon.
Oh, it's always great to be on your show, Drew.
I had somebody on the air with me just recently saying, you got to read the book, Unintended Dystopia. You remember that, Maggie? I forget what we were talking about. And I said, oh, Russ White, we've had him on before. Great book about social media impact. Love your point. We'll start maybe first with what I was talking about initially. We had a physician on just recently, a psychiatrist, on the impact of social media on the brain, on depression, and on anxiety. I don't know how familiar you are with all that. And then also the decline of social media, as T.J. Burdick is making the case. How do you see that impacting society at large? And ultimately, do you think social media will die, or do you think it's only going to become more pervasive?
So I would say, if you've ever read Nicholas Carr, The Shallows, you're in the same territory where he's talking about the neuroplasticity of the mind and how the way that we search for things changes the way we think. And we see this, by the way, in biblical studies. We love to search for things and find things, but we don't really think too much about the narratives. I mean, I wrote a paper with Dr. Doug Bookman about this that we presented at the International Association of Christian Apologists. And our entire point was we have totally started just ignoring the narratives in the past, in the scriptures. And this is all down, not all down, but a lot of this is down to neuroplasticity and just the way that we think information should come to us nowadays. So I think there's a real danger there. And of course, the depression that the doctor was talking about, those are shown to be real things. Yep. There's a great paper out there called, Highlight Reels, Living Your Life by Highlight Reels. And it talks about how we compare ourselves to others constantly. So these are all effects of it. But I don't really think social media is going away. I think social media is going away in the way that we see it. And I think ChatGPT is one of the ways that we're going to see social media, or what I like to call neuro-digital media, come back into the fore. Because it's more like electronics. Remember 50 or 100 years ago, not even 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, whatever it was. Man, when you had a radio, you know how many transistors were in your radio. You know all this stuff about you. Oh, man, I have a radio. Look at all this cool stuff about this radio, right?
Yeah, right.
And nowadays, radios are in everything, right? They're in everything. Yep, yep. They're ubiquitous. And I think social media is becoming the same way. Social media is becoming shopping. It's becoming cars. It's becoming maps. It's becoming writing papers and everything else. And see, this is where ChatGPT comes in, because really it's just another form of neuro-digital media. It's just another, I'm going to take the inputs from millions of people and I'm going to summarize them and write a neural network that's going to generate text that the computer's not thinking. It's just generating something it thinks you're going to find pleasant. Or useful, I think it's search engines.
I think it's the future, to be honest with you. I really do. I was saying to my producer here, Maggie, in the studio, I said, There was a time people would get off their couch to change the channel on their TV, which only had three stations. And now you do it with a remote, or you can even do it voice activated. In some cases, you've got smartphones that have more technology in them than the Apollo 11 mission had, and that spacecraft that landed on it. And we're going to be having cars that are going to drive us to our doctor's appointments. You know, so this AI and this technology is constantly evolving. And I think we're going to be able to speak to a device like, you know, ChatGPT and say to them, hey, research this or find that, or I've got bad code. How do you fix that? You know, you're going to have this, I think, built into all your technology. You know, you could say to your stove, I need to cook my turkey. It says, how many pounds is it and how long should I cook it, right? And it'll automatically do whatever you need to do. It's going to be pretty cool stuff. Are there dangers to it? I want to talk about that with you as well. And I want to talk about what this really portends for the future, and for so many. This is the future, and it's coming. When I come back, we'll pick that up, okay? My guest today, Russ White, if you want to join us, 888-914-9149. The world is changing rapidly. There's new technology that is just out. I think it's in its infancy. I mean, I messed with it. There were so many people going online to it, I could barely get on it. Once I was able to check it out, I was pretty amazed. It wasn't really that great, but it's the beta version. They're going to fine-tune this. And just like that clunky cell phone you had and your iPhone 14 today, there's going to be a rapid evolution. Our conversation will continue. There's more straight ahead.
Getting you connected.
The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio. This is the Drew Mariani Show.
You know, we receive over a million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor could support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Your news, your issues, your opinion. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Well, thanks for joining me. I have a little bit of breaking news to share with you just coming in. Cardinal George Pell has been called home to God at the age of 81. He is that Australian cardinal. He's been on the broadcast with us in the past. You might remember he did some time in prison over there under a false accusation. The Age and Sydney Morning Herald confirmed the news. Multiple sources are now reporting on it. The cardinal has passed away. He's believed to have died from complications from a hip replacement, of all things. And we'll remember him and his passing, especially in our prayers. Good man, and I'll share a little bit more with you in the days ahead. Good bishop, a good cardinal, I really should say. And he wrote very powerful memoirs. You really should read those. If you're just joining me, I only have a few moments left. I'm speaking with Russ White today, and I stumbled across something over the weekend, and you might have seen this. There's been a lot of news reports on it. There's been a lot of writing on this recently. Something called ChatGPT, and it brings... how do I put it? It's a chatbot equipped with the most advanced example of generative artificial intelligence. And a lot of people say, look, it's very powerful technology. It can create original answers to questions and commands. It can write poems. It can write you essays. It's eerily human-like. And some see it as posing a threat to Google, you know, and one insider thought, man, what's this mean? They found it, one of the guys who researches found it scarily impressive. That's what he said. It can write cover letters for real jobs. College students want to do it to write their school papers. I saw one reporter said, well, they're also going to have AI that will determine whether or not this is an AI work or an original piece. And again, it's not perfect, but we'll see. We'll see. We're talking about it today, as I said, with Russ White. And if you had any questions, feel free to join us. I have a few moments left with him as well. Russ, let's talk about, you know, this technology, what it really is. Is it biased? Who created it? And ultimately, how can it be used? I see that hackers right now are asking it to write malicious code for them. So your thoughts on that and what you do know?
Yeah, it's actually being used by hackers to build what are called spear phishing emails. So those fake emails that you get from your bank that aren't really from your bank, and they always struggle. I mean, I received one the other day that opened, the opening sentence was dear, comma. And I thought, my bank better not be calling me dear. Right. Okay, I'm sorry. but if my bank is calling me dear, we're about to have an attitude adjustment. But anyway, it was a scam. And, you know, ChatGPT is being used to write these scams. Now, there's a couple of things about it. First of all, it's based on human input, right? It's nothing more than a neural network or a group of computer programs that sort and sift common answers and generate new answers based on those common answers. So it's not like it's totally a human. Like there are human elements to it. And some people have reported that there are actual humans sitting in the background for some of the answers, which, by the way, is true of like when you do Alexa and you say, hey, Alexa, and you say, tell me the time. If Alexa doesn't understand you, in some call center in India or in Mexico or something, there may be a person sitting there listening to you and telling Alexa what to say. Like it's not totally human free.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So, but the other thing is that also means it's biased, right? The information, we have a thing in computers, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. And by the way, I tell my kids this all the time, you know, whatever you read and whatever you listen to, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. And so they all laugh when I say it now, but it's absolutely true that the ChatGPT is based on Google search and primarily and Microsoft search and stuff like that. And these search engines, themselves are biased. So therefore, obviously the answers are going to be biased. There's just no way around that.
I don't mean to step on you, but you were sharing with Maggie and I when we talked about the bias, that does it tend to lean Democratic?
It tends to lean progressive.
Progressive.
Okay. I don't want to use the word Democratic. I want to use the word progressive.
Okay,
it tends to lean progressive in almost all things. So that's the information it's been fed, right?
Right.
It's a database and it's being fed this information. So that's what it does. I don't know if you've ever heard of the search engine manipulation effect, SEMI.
No,
it was a thing. There's a congressional testimony on this about how many votes are swayed each year by autocomplete on the part of Google and Bing and stuff like that. All these search engines, like if you type in, Donald Trump, it gives you negative things. If you type in Hillary Clinton, it gives you positive. Wow. But so it's all in that same vein. It's the same sort of bias is what you're seeing. So as far as people go, I mean, I was reading this article just yesterday that talked about how character development is something that you see in novels and you don't see in real life anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think the human person is kind of doesn't develop character without facing down demons, in a sense, having struggles. And the more we build this stuff so that we don't struggle, the less character we as humans are going to have ultimately. That's a little disturbing in all of its thought processes.
That's a really good point. Hey, I want to bring Maggie, my producer, in. She said she heard an engineer that asked an AI, it was an astronaut. And Maggie, share with Russ what you shared to me right before we went to air.
I was pretty sure I had read this article a while back. I thought it was someone at NASA had asked an artificial intelligence entity that they had been interacting with if AI should exist. And the AI responded no, because through its logic of thinking, it said it's a tool like anything else, and unfortunately, AI is controlled by humans, which are unpredictable, and we can't tell if humans are moral or not. I don't think humans know if they're moral or not. And so it was like, it went through this whole thing, and it was like, no, AI should not exist. Wow. And I was like, whoa.
Fascinating.
Well, does AI actually exist? That's an entire question, right?
Oh, boy.
Is this really AI? I would say no.
Can the AI self-learn and get better, though, and eradicate some of its bias?
Well, why would it want to? AIs, neural networks are very much like children, right? You're teaching them, except they're like permanent 5-year-olds or permanent 3-year-olds or something.
Wow.
You're teaching them. Yeah. And the more you give them approval, the more you say this is the right answer, the more they're going to go to that answer.
Yeah. Hey, Russ, I only have a moment or two left. I came across a story today in my feed. I just want to run this by you because to me, this is the future. I mean, AI is going to be integrated into everything that we have.
Yep,
I saw a story that there's an AI-powered robot lawyer that's going to present the first ever to take a court to case. And he's going to defend it's a traffic ticket case somewhere. These guys, the AI knows the law better than probably some lawyers. Will we see robot lawyers?
I'm sure we'll see robot doctors and robot lawyers and, robot everything. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but I'm sure we'll see it.
That's fascinating. Hey, Russ, if people want to check out Unintended Dystopia, how do they get your book?
It's available on Whip and Stock's webpage. It's available on Amazon. I don't have a blog in that side of the world yet. My only blog is over on the tech side. So,
well, first of all, I love talking with you. It's always a great conversation. I want to do it again. We'll have to talk about Unintended Dystopia again, and we'll continue to explore these ideas. Thank you for making time for me today and for all of us.
You.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, great.
All right, I'm out of time for the day. I want to thank you for allowing me to be part of your afternoon. If you missed any of the conversation, check out my podcast. Until tomorrow, God bless.